Last July 2018, Amazon touted the success of its second annual Prime Day promotion in a press release. It rattled off how much stuff people bought in different categories. 90,000 televisions sold one day, 2 million toys, 1 million pairs of shoes, 200,000 headphones, and 215,000 Instant Pot 7-in-1 multifunctional pressure cookers. Whoa. Well, that's a lot for one product. There's an article that was written about this on Inc.com. It's a business magazine. And it's entitled, How a Tiny Company with No Marketing Built the Number One Product on Amazon. And it's a lesson of how to sell $14.8 million worth of product in a single day without any advertising. Well, what they did is they took 215,000, or take 14.8 million times the lowest selling price, and they divide it out, and they came out 215,000 times 69 bucks comes up to that amount. But the price range of the different models goes from $69 to $99 for this particular household item. There was an article written by Barry Brownstein on the Foundation for Economics for Education website. And he explained this phenomenon, how a product can have so many sales by, with no advertising, word of mouth, viral advertising, all in one day. And they give the background to the story. In 2008, Dr. Wang, a Chinese immigrant to Canada with a PhD in computer science, was laid off from his job. With his savings and the help of two other engineers, he founded his company, Double Insight. The future would hold profit or loss, they didn't know. In 18 months, the Instant Pot was invented. So they had many trials until they could perfect it. And he went on to write the philosophy of Dr. Wang was that successful entrepreneurs have empathy for the consumer. There was in his book, Wired to Care, there was a business advisor, Dev Patnick, argues the secret source of innovation is empathy. Success requires businesses to leave their own agendas behind and actually care about how other people see the world. The highest expression of empathy, according to Jeff Booth, the CEO of BuildDirect company, he says, is addressing consumer needs before they're even aware of them. He concludes, when you step into your customer's shoes and see the world from their perspective, not yours, it's easier to walk miles ahead of the competition. Well, Dr. Wang, who is the inventor of the Instant Pot, knows the open secret of business success, which is empathy. Empathy, not greed, is the essence of an entrepreneurial mindset that fosters innovation to meet the needs of customers. Years ago, there was a book written by W. Cleon Skousen entitled 5,000 Year Leap. And he noted that for 5,000 years of recorded history, people obtained wealth by just taking stuff from other people. That's what empires were. It's how companies or countries grew, and they expanded. And then in the mid-1700s, something changed. In 1776, a Scottish economist named Adam Smith wrote a book entitled Wealth of Nations. And he explained that the free market exchange of goods and services was critical to build wealth. Now, this was a Scottish philosopher who became the first modern economist. And his philosophy or his book coincided with the birth of a new nation, 1776, and this new nation being the United States of America. And Smith's economic philosophy was well received and taken on. With then the birth of the United States and its new economic system, people began to gain wealth. They didn't gain wealth by taking things from other people, but by serving the needs and wants of other people. Using the philosophy of serving the needs and wants of others, the United States has then grown to become the wealthiest nation in world history. It was about close to 30 years ago, Zig Ziglar, an author and motivational speaker, summed it up very nicely. You can get everything you want if you help enough other people get what they want. Well, the principle of empathy that Zig Ziglar and Cleon Skousen and Dr. Wang followed isn't a new principle. Indeed, the principle of serving the needs of others is thousands of years old. And empathy is a biblical principle that's essential for Christians. So today, the title of today's message is Empathy is at the Core of Christianity. Empathy is at the core of Christianity. Well, we need to come up with a definition of empathy here. So Oxford Dictionary says, empathy is the ability to understand and share the feelings of another. Merriam-Webster Dictionary says, empathy is the action of understanding, being aware of or sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, and experience of another, either past or present. So empathy, then, is understanding the feelings of others. Now, there's a slightly different definition for compassion, which says understanding the feelings of others and then move to action. Well, for our purposes today, we're going to conflate those because most people do, meaning consider them together with empathy and compassion together. You might want to turn to Matthew 7:12. We're going to turn there in a moment. Recently, I was appointed to serve on a special committee set up by my school district. The committee was to examine and to teach and reinforce the concept of compassion to students. And I went to that meeting last Monday. The title of this subject I wrote about a year ago and had some outlines. And then last Monday, this fell into my lap, this meeting, you know, the concept of teaching compassion to students, which I thought was interesting. I wondered, why was I appointed to this particular committee? And I listened quietly through the presentation. And the goal of teaching compassion is admirable. However, what I came to realize during the meeting is that the promoters were attempting to outline a path to teach compassion while they were absent the knowledge of God. They were absent the recognition that the laws of God are essential to well-being and happiness of mankind. The promoters of the compassion agenda are attempting to instill values in a world without absolutes. Well, they had four principles that they wanted us all to adopt and to sign on to. And as I looked over these principles, I thought, how interesting. They don't know where these principles come from, but I'm going to share these principles with you today, and we'll see where they really do come from. It's sort of like, as a child, how old were we when we discovered gravity? Well, we try to walk at what? Somewhere around 10 months of age, we really discover it then. Did we have to be Sir Isaac Newton and have an apple drop on our head from a tree? And think about, why did this occur? No, we figured it out all on ourselves without any particular education. We figured out that gravity was true every single time, and it works every single time. Well, the four principles of compassion that we're supposed to come up with a program to teach, the first principle is, and I know this is going to be a shock to those listening, number one, treat everyone as we wish to be treated. Where have we heard this before? Let's turn to Matthew 7 and verse 12. Treat everyone as we would wish to be treated. Matthew 7:12, therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. In other words, this is the focus of the law and the prophets. This is what the prophets are talking about. You follow the law, this is what's going to occur. We know this, of course, as the golden rule. This is mirrored in Luke 6:31. And just as you want men to do to you, you also do to them likewise. Now, most people want nice things done to them. So the clue is here, well, then you should do nice things to and for other people. This is also mirrored in Matthew 22. if we look in Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40, this story is also mirrored in Mark 12. But I want to go through this, Matthew 22, starting in verse 34. And Jesus Christ is talking. And verse 34, Matthew 22, but when the Pharisees had heard that he, meaning Christ, had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? Let's see how he answers this one, right? It's trying to trick him. And Christ said, verse 37, Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So Christ summarized it quite well. Love God, and then love your neighbor as yourself. So In other words, that's the essence. That's the teaching. The law is there to teach us to do this. Let's turn to Romans 13, verses 8 and 9. In Romans 13, 8 and 9, owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. They're doing what the law wants you to do. Verse 9, for the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, they're all summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So we have the Paul writing to the Romans saying, this is really how you love your neighbor and yourself, is by following the Ten Commandments. Paul also wrote to the Galatians. In chapter 5 and verse 13, Galatians 5:13, when he wrote, for you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Well, let's stop right there. What's liberty? You're free to make decisions. You're free to decide to do what God has given you, the agency to make choices. So you've been called to liberty. Let's continue on. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh. In other words, just not to satisfy your own sensuality. But through love, serve one another. For all law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. So we're free to do a lot of things, and in that we should love ourselves and then love our neighbor. Now, I'm on an online forum for teachers of a particular subject, and it's a rather challenging forum because I teach a college class called Advanced Placement U.S. Government and Politics. And can you imagine that people get rather saucy when it comes to different political ideas? Well, in my classroom, we have this policy. We simply don't argue. We teach structure and function. And if you have a belief that wanders off, well, that's yours, but you're not going to be doing it in the classroom. But online, the forums tend to get a little woolly and wild. And it's interesting, well, at least for a little while, the a fellow apparently thought it would be entirely appropriate, as many do, is to really rip into somebody else for a comment, you know, just jabbing them. And I made the comment, and I usually restrain myself, and I pride myself on how much restraint, but that day I wasn't a restrainer. And I said, do you carry this approach into your classroom? And that unleashed a whole tirade of, in other words, I was apparently opened myself up to a plenty of abuse. But some people will snipe, they will bite from the safety of their distant keyboard. So, and sure enough, there's this verse, if you bite and devour one another, you can consume one another. It'll eat up all of your time and your energy for biting and consuming. And so so the golden rule is fundamentally, and that's point one, treat everyone as we would wish to be treated. Now, there's two sub-points to point one. And so I have sub-point A is help those around us who are in need. Now, this is, I'm reading from the school's objectives here. Okay, so sub-point one, or sub-point A, help those around us who are in need. So if you're a teacher and you're trying to model this and teach this, those are around us. Well, let's help those who are in need. Let's turn to Matthew 25, and starting in verse 31. What does it mean to help those around us who are in need? In Matthew 25, starting in verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, and he will sit on the throne of his glory, this is at a time when Christ returns. Verse 32, all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. There'll be a separation. Verse 33, and he will set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come you, blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Verse 37, then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or where and when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So acting that out, serving the needs of others around us, is as Christ gave that example of those who will enter into the kingdom. It's summarized, as the Apostle James wrote in James 1:27, Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world, actually doing something, to visit them in their trouble, in other words, in their time of difficulty. It's nice to acknowledge that this exists, but then we must do something. And that means everybody, not because we have a particular position or not. In Ezra 5:2, we have that example. In Ezra 5:2, and this is at a time when the Jews had been carried away to Babylon, and some of them came back after 70 years to build the temple, to rebuild the temple. And so let's go to Ezra 5 and verse 2. So Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. It doesn't stop there. It says, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. Just because a prophet may have had a particular position and had served a special function, they pitched in and did it. Everybody pitched in to help build. And as we heard in the sermonette today, what are we here to do? All of us, our function is to prepare a people, preach the gospel and prepare a people. We're all to be jumping in to do that. In Philippians 2:4, we read the principle. In Philippians 2:4, let each of you look out not only for his own interests. I'm going to stop in the middle of the verse. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests. They're saying, look out for your own interests, but don't stop there. Let's keep going now with going to the verse, but also the interests of others. In other words, look to yourself and then go beyond looking to yourself to help other people. Well, how much? How much is enough? How much is too much? In Luke 6, in verse 38, we read how much. In Luke 6:38, give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. So to the extent that we step beyond ourselves to be able to help others, that will come back to you. As we read, Christ said, those, you know, entering into the kingdom, when did we clothe you? When did we feed you? When did we give you drink? Well, they didn't even realize that they were doing it, at Christ's admonition. When you're baking bread, you measure how many cups of flour. The more cups of flour, the more bread you're going to get, right? We think of that's pretty easy in the recipe. But how many of us look at that same recipe when we're looking then with the measure, it says in Luke 6, to be able to assist others? And then you say, well, I'm doing all I can, which may be true, and most of us are. I would say pretty much all of us are, because this is a wonderful congregation where everybody's engaged and involved, and it is the delight to go somewhere and to be able to brag about the local congregation, as it were, that everybody's engaged and involved. It is a delight. If we take a look in Galatians 6 and verse 2, this is one thing that we do. We bear another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. We're looking to each other. How can we lift each other up? Bear those burdens. Are they having difficulties? Are they having trials? How can we help them? How can we step in? How can we encourage them? We're bearing another's burdens. Because what is that doing? The law of Christ is teaching us how to live in a godly fashion. And if we have the capacity to help others and we don't do it, well, that could be a problem. In 1 John 3:17, but whoever has this world's good and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? So it's one thing to say that we have care, concern, empathy for others, but it's a separate thing to actually have that care, concern, and empathy for others. I know in Passover season or in Passover service each year, we read John 15 and verse 12. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. And so empathy is really then expressing that the love of God that is given to us, and that we express that to others. And of course, we're all familiar with James in chapter 2 and verses 14 through 17. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but doesn't have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Now, I've done this unknowingly. I thought later, I missed an opportunity. I should have. What was I thinking? You know, there was the opportunity before me, and I didn't even realize it. And only when it was that opportunity was passed that I thought, oh no, well, they think that I had the attitude, be warmed and fed, and, you know, good luck to you, buddy. Hope it all works out. And I just didn't connect, and I should have connected. In Proverbs 3:27, English Standard Version, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. It's a long-standing principle. This is not something that the people that are trying to teach compassion, they just stumbled across this. But knowing what I know about them, they are not Bible readers. They're putting this together as if it's a new thing. Okay, and yet those of us who understand what the expectations of God are, know what this book is about, know that these principles have been around for a long time. So the summary of 1A is to help those around us who are in need. And then there's 1B, the second subpoint on the first one. And this one's make amends when we cause another person pain. Well, you can imagine this in school. Other people cause other people pain from time to time. Now, I'm very fortunate that we have a faculty where everybody seems to get along, and it's not a lot of backbiting and sniping. Doesn't always happen that way with teenagers. When you have hundreds of teenagers, there's going to be some friction here or there. Now, I must say that I have never seen an out-and-out fight at the school I'm at. Now, I have elsewhere, okay, where they're going at it fisticuffs with kicks and blows and blood and everything else, and it can be very exciting. It's a good place not to be when that happens. And other people cause, some people do it verbally, and they're very cutting when they do it verbally, and some people do it physically. I'm happy that I don't have to be around those that are physically driving. But some people cause other people pain. We don't even know it sometimes. I mean, I have the capacity to irritate other people. I've figured out over the years by saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, probably for the wrong reason. I'm going, what? How'd that ever happen? And so making amends when we cause another person pain. We don't even know sometimes that we're causing someone else pain. In Ephesians 4:26, we're admonished to be angry, but don't sin. But it doesn't stop there. It says, you know, we understand, you know, it's the Bible saying, you know, we understand there are some things you're going to be angry about. Christ was angry about something, but the verse continues, do not let the sun go down on your wrath. There needs to be a way to resolve it. If you're angry, whether somebody else caused you pain or you caused somebody else's pain, you would need to put a time limit and wrap that up as soon as you can. And this is in several verses. I saw several different commentaries or versions of this verse that basically says, don't go to bed angry, or it's really going to stir you up. So it's do your best to resolve the issue. Well, how do you resolve the issue? In Matthew 6:12. In Matthew 6:12, we have on the Sermon on the Mount, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. But what if we don't quite get around to forgiving our debtors, people that You know, they've really maligned us. God is likely to be as forgiving with us? And this whole subject really needs a separate sermon and a separate focus. But I did want to cover just this thought that we have to have that mindset that we want to make amends when we cause someone pain. In Matthew 21, as long as we're in Matthew 21:21. What if someone causes us pain and then they cause us pain again? And then again? And again? There's some people that have the capacity to irritate me over and over again. And I'm thinking, just like it is in this verse, in Matthew 21:21, Peter came to him and said, "Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him?" Up to seven times? So that's quite a bit. If somebody does the same thing to you seven times, and you presume by then they know it, okay, it's fair to say that now we're no accident, it's deliberate. Verse 22, and Jesus said to him, "I don't say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven." The principle is that did we sin only seven times and then God said, "Well, that's the limit? And I guess you're one of the goats off to this side over here, goat." Or did God extend to us some forgiveness along the way that we may be one of the sheep that enters on the right side when he returns to usher us into the kingdom? So we need to have in our mind the opportunity to forgive. Now, of course, forgiveness is another issue. There has to be, there may be no repentance by the other side. They may be willing to quite do us dirt on a continual basis, and we'll deal with that in another subject. But the willingness has to be on our part to make amends, if possible, when we cause another person's pain, which is point 1b. Then let's go into point number two of teaching compassion. Step into the shoes of others and see how things look from their point of view. Sounds reasonable, right? Wouldn't you like to be able to teach that? Step into the shoes of others and see how things look from their point of view. Well, I wear special shoes, and if other people wore them, I'm sure they would find it difficult to walk or run. Some negative heels, and you walk like a duck. Some are rocker bottoms, and you can tip over with those. So you kind of have to know. So if other people are going to walk in my shoes, they're going to have to learn that first. But the same thing is true if I'm walking in other people's shoes. They all have their own idiosyncrasies. But that's really a greater statement for what's life like for them. 40 years ago, can't believe this is 40 years ago, but I had a class of seventh graders. And I had a little boy, first day of school, second day of school, problems up one end, and third day, fourth day. By the time we get to the fourth and fifth day, he was trouble up one side and down the other, 30 seventh graders. And I'm sure that this is one of the reasons that I did not continue on in teaching, although at least I learned something from the seventh graders. And the little boy, I'd really had it with him. I said, "Now, buddy," I took him out in the hall privately, and I said, "I've given you three chances over and over again." I wasn't mindful of the 70 times 7, but he wasn't repentant either. And I said, "It's time for you to be excused from the classroom. So you're going to have to go sit at the office because you've demonstrated that you are unable to comport yourself with other people. It's disturbing the class. And as much as I'd like you to be here, I'm going to have to separate you out." And the little boy, and he was not very big, he looked up at me with pleading eyes and he said, "Please don't do this." And I said, "Well, why not?" I said, you've had every opportunity to change. And he said, "I will go to my seat and I will sit down and I will shut up and do everything you tell me." I said, "But that's what we've been doing all week." He said, "Well, I will do whatever you want. Do not send me to the principal's office." This is the first week of school. I said, "Well, why not?" I said, "It solves my problem for the classroom. Everybody else is going to be peaceful." I said, "And you'll be happier too because you'll be sitting there." He says, Well, not exactly, he said. The principal will call my mother. And then she will have to disrupt her work and come and get me. And then when I get home, I will get smacked by my mother. And then her boyfriend will smack me and beat me. And then my dad will find out and I'll get a third beating. He says, I'd rather just sit in the corner and be quiet. I did not know his world and his background. And yet he was acting out. And there I am. I'm stunned. I'm going, you know, how little I knew. Because I didn't grow up like that. You know, I didn't have those circumstances where it was. I was unable to step into his shoes until I knew more about his circumstances. And you know, he went and sat in this, I set him in the room in the corner, and he was quiet, and he did his work, and he was no longer disruptive. We had a meeting of the minds. He knew that the tolerance was over. He also knew what was going to happen through no direct action of mine, it would be indirect, that life would go really hard for him. Do we step into the shoes of others, people that we don't know? We can't if we don't know them well enough in order to see what life looks like. You know, Jesus Christ stepped into our shoes when he was emptied into human flesh. And then he saw how hard it was and lived the human life. In John 3:16, and verse 6, there's John 3:16 and verse 17, the most often quoted scripture, I believe, in the Christian world, certainly among all churchianity, if I could say it that way. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. So there is a God sent Jesus Christ to have those same experiences that we did. We can't say, well, he couldn't know. He didn't know. Well, of course he did. He was there. He felt the pain. In John 15:13, in English Standard Version, it reads this way, greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. That's the ultimate sacrifice, is that when you step into someone else's shoes and say, I'll take the hit, I will do this. That is Jesus Christ setting the model. Paul wrote to the church in Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians 11, and he started the chapter with this verse. Imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. That's an instruction for us. We are to follow Christ, just as Paul is following Jesus Christ. And that means we should look at the world from other people's point of view. We don't know them. We don't know their point of view until we get to know them, until we try to understand what is happening and be as reasonable and forgivable as we can with them. So point two is to step into the shoes of others, see how things look from their point of view. Point three, the school list has, stand up to bullying to make our environment a place where everyone feels welcome. Well, how are we going to teach that? That's interesting. I know how I stood up to bullying when I was in elementary school, and I probably don't want to share that with you right now. I have a crooked finger to show how that worked out. So in Ephesians 4:29, in the English Standard Version, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. Because, you know, before you get to fisticuffs, it's usually words are spent. People are saying things that they shouldn't say, and that's the corrupting talk coming out of their mouths. My dad can beat up your dad. Huh, my dad can beat up your dad. You know, the elementary school kids that go at it, and then it goes downhill from there. Paul wrote to the church in Thessalonica in 1 Thessalonians 5:11, again, English Standard Version, in 1 Thessalonians 5:11, encourage one another, build one another up, just as you are doing. You know, I complained to the school counselor. I was in junior high, and I remember telling him, I said, there's some bullies here in school, and this one, and this one, and this one. I says, they just seem to me that I'm their target, like I'm one of their favorite people to pick on. And I said, how am I supposed to handle this? Now, what was I, 12 or 13 at the time? And he said something that I haven't forgotten. And he said, they're very insecure. You should ask them for their help. And I thought, what are you, some kind of nut? You know, these are bullies, you know. They'll push and shove or punch whenever they think they can get away with it. He said, nobody ever asks them for help. They're so insecure that they can only show with their fists what they cannot do because of their because nobody otherwise would respect them. So I thought and I thought and I thought on that for a very long time. I could never figure out, you know, exactly how do you ask someone who was, of limited intellect for their help on anything. But you know, the world has a way of thumping those people. They show them the limits. And it was about 30 years later that I had occasion to visit the courthouse, and I thought, and I stopped in to look in the courtroom. Well, yeah, there's quite a few people there. And what an interesting day. There was Mr. Bully, 30 years later, and he was, we're in our 40s now, and he was humbly standing before the judge with a list of things and the judge was repeating all the things that he shouldn't have done and what his punishment would be. And I thought, he brought that on himself over the years, and it was a sad situation for him because he was bullying others, and he never stopped. He never learned that. Well, how do you do this? And at this point, I'd like to say, well, let's just insert that sermon I gave on how to correct other people. We'll just insert that into that 45 minutes in here. But there's just a couple of verses. Ephesians 4:2. How do you help someone who has that issue? In Ephesians 4:2, I have the English Standard Version, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, being gentle, being kind, with patience. Things aren't going to turn around in a moment, but using gentleness. And I'm thinking, I don't have it in my notes, but I'm thinking of the proverb that as surely as the ringing of the nose brings forth blood, so a strong word brings forth wrath. You know, if you say the wrong thing, you can really trigger something there. In Titus 3:2, similarly, speak evil of no one to avoid quarreling. Be gentle. Show perfect courtesy toward all people. Oh, here's the Proverbs. I guess I did write it down. Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath. Harsh word stirs up anger. So if you, doing the soft word, and people have used soft words with me and stopped me short, thankfully, for what could have transpired. Because they were doing it with a soft answer and with patience. The last verse I have on this one is Proverbs 25, verse 15. And I thought, how often this occurs in Proverbs 25, 15. With patience, a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue will break a bone. Whoa. In other words, how powerful can the right words be that can cause some action that's very severe, or strong action as a result, using soft words? Because to break a bone, it takes considerable, impact. And so your words can have a huge impact. So the point three that we're supposed to teach is stand up to bullying to make our environment a place where everyone feels welcome. The fourth point to teach compassion is to respond to others with kindness, to imagine a better and more compassionate world. So treating people with kindness, and imagine, of course, I thought of the song about John Lennon's song, but that gets somewhat afar. In Ephesians 4:32, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. And so responding to others in kindness, they say the best sermon is not what we say, but what we live. So be kind to one another. In Proverbs 11:17, a man who is kind benefits himself. Whoa. So it's not just because we're supposed to for the benefit of other people, benefits himself, but the verse continues. But a cruel man hurts himself. In other words, that bad consequence will come from that, will affect the person that's being cruel. 1 Corinthians 13, how many of us know pieces of that by heart? Love is patient, love is kind. It doesn't envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It doesn't rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So this whole concept of being kind to one another, and of course, I'm just going to paraphrase here the parable of the Good Samaritan when Christ was approached and says, "Who's my neighbor?" And Christ goes through the example of the Good Samaritan. And he led the person who was asking the question through it. And finally, at the end of the story, Christ says, "So, who's your neighbor?" And the man said, "The one who showed mercy on the person who was beat up." And Christ said, "Go and do likewise." Well, so stepping into being empathetic, seeing the world from the point of view of others, is what the Bible teaches emphatically. But how do you learn this? Where do you learn empathy? Author Warren Farrell, in his book Father and Child Reunion, displayed a lot of research that a well-functioning family needs both father and mother to raise well-adjusted children. However, and they go through statistically, the ones that have the intact family, the percentage of children that grow up that have the least incidence of all of these things that can go wrong, the least incidence are with intact families. And then when you have families that are where it's not mom and dad as the biological mom and dad raising the child, you have a series of dysfunctions and they increase dramatically. And this is true because the mother and father have separate roles. The father, according to Mr. Farrell's research, is the one that teaches empathy by providing limits or rules of respect for others. So by respecting the limits of other people, children then learn empathy. So let's take a look in Exodus 20 and the Ten Commandments. Let's take a look how the Ten Commandments emphasize the principle of empathy. Exodus 20, starting in verse 1. And God spoke these words, saying, "I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me." So, God comes first. And remember, repeatedly, we've heard the two principal commandments were love God and then love your neighbor as yourself. So we're hearing this repeated in this form. First of all, loving God. God comes first. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. God comes first. Verse 4, you shall not make yourself a carved image, any likeness that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And you look at that verse, it sounds a little odd, but what happens is the ones that do not follow God, what are they teaching their children? And their children are the ones that are learning the bad behavior, and that goes on for generations because they didn't respect God. They were teaching something else, putting an image in front before God. And so that behavior travels down. They say that the sins of the parents are displayed by the children, which is really awkward. When you look at your own kids, you say, "Oh no, I wish they wouldn't do that." You know, because oh no, who taught them that? And then there you go. And then the verse 6, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. That's the hope and the forgiveness that God is offering to those, even if they're stuck in that circumstance. Verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. God's setting limits here. He's saying, only one God. Don't make gods or false images. Don't take God's name in vain. He's putting the limits. God the Father is setting the extreme limits of saying, don't go past this point. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. And he goes through that verse and calls the attention to the week of creation. So that, there's a limit. God puts that limit in place for us to observe for our benefit. Verse 12, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. There's another limit that's placed there. God is teaching us limits. What should we do? Respecting our parents. And there's a blessing involved for that, that things will go well with you. Now we have more limits. Verse 13, you shall not murder. Well, that's really difficult to keep now, isn't it? Except that if we look beyond that, don't murder, not just in the physical murder, do we murder people's reputation and so forth? Do we think it in our heart? Verse 14, you shall not commit adultery, which is just like murdering a family when families split up. Verse 15, you shall not steal. There again, setting a limit. God is setting a limit. It says, if you want to get along with everybody take care of your own stuff. Don't go messing with the stuff of someone else. Verse 16, you shall not bear false witness, but it has another three words on there, against your neighbor. In other words, you know, with evil intent, why are you trying to trip up your neighbor? Why are you trying to do something like that? Don't do that. Setting the limits. Now, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house or wife or male servant, female servant, or ox, nor donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. In other words, don't even let it get into your mind that that is what you should pursue. So if you're going to respond to others with kindness, you need to respect the limits that God has set for mankind, and then you'll be able to better respect the limits of others, and that gives reason to be kind. So to imagine a better and more compassionate world, haven't we been called to do what? Preach the gospel of the coming kingdom of God? That's the better and more compassionate world. So what if the first point is to treat everyone as we should wish to be treated, golden rule. Two sub-points, help those around us who are in need. The second sub-point, make amends when we cause another person pain. Point two, step into the shoes of others and see how things look from their point of view, especially if we disagree or in conflict. Number three, make our environment a place where everyone feels welcome, meaning stand up to bullying. And number four, respond to others with kindness to imagine a better and more compassionate world. You see, empathy is at the core of Christianity. Empathy, the ability to understand and share the feelings of another, and being aware of or sensitive to or vicariously experiencing the thoughts and experience of another, either past or present. The sermonette today, I was pleased to see, it was about preparing a people, and that begins with preparing ourselves. So as we prepare ourselves for this coming Passover season, let us bear in mind that empathy is at the core of Christianity.